Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this, our 10th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster recording and taking pictures, Haiwan Wan. Shaden Pruitt and Daniel Peach designed our posters, thank you, and our technical specialist tonight is the library's technology coordinator, David Runner. Our speaker tonight is a native of Louisville, Kentucky, where his family has lived for his entire life, he says. He was influenced by his father's vocation as a writer, and his interest in films dates from Saturday matinees at the Uptown Theater in Louisville. He aspired to be like the young directors Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola and a little Francois Truffaut thrown in for good measure. In 1967, he enrolled at the University of Kentucky, where he studied English and history primarily, and in 1975, he began work as a communications professional. 10 years later, he established his own video production company, Duckworks Incorporated. Their first production was a change of order about the change of a group of nuns was undergoing as a result of declining membership. And it was produced in 1987 and aired on KET. For the past two decades, his work as an independent producer-director has focused on issues of community and culture. He's produced 15 films, which have been featured on PBS, KET, and shown in many film festivals. Some of his most recent projects include Soul Searching, a documentary on Thomas Merton, and Uncommon Vision, the life of John Howard Griffin, author of the book Black Like Me. Other award-winning documentaries include Live Music, the story of Louisville musician Tim Krekel, A Way of Life, a reflection on Kentucky's passion for basketball, Fall City, a look at Louisville's ill-fated Falls Fountain, and Gethsemane, an account of life at the Trappist Monastery in rural Kentucky. His current project is a film, Wonder, on the life and times of Anna and Harlan Hubbard, who were early pioneers of sustainability in Kentucky. Please give a warm welcome to Morgan Atkinson. Morgan.
Thank you, Brian. It's very good to be here. It's great to be here at Western. As Brian said, I went to UK, but I used to come here on weekends and see friends, and I have many fond memories. Some a little more foggy than others. The campus looks great. You know, I can tell that your president has done a good job raising money. And as a Kentucky grad, they might de-emphasize the football program a little bit because they've just... I sort of cheered for that because it was so obvious that Western had the better team, and it's nice to sort of get things in perspective. Brian asked me about creative influences, and you know, who knows what goes into making you do what you do or think something is important or worth doing stories about. But my father was a writer for the Courier Journal, actually for the Louisville Times. I mean, that shows how long ago it was. It was when a town could have a morning paper and an afternoon paper. I mean, how odd that seems now. But he wrote a column that was about family life, about community, a lot about our family. And I think seeing that and the way people responded to that, sort of the special niche he held in our community, made me think, that looks pretty good. And unfortunately, I didn't get all of his writing genes, so I don't have the gift that he had. He went on and wrote for television in Los Angeles, wrote for several popular shows, and I didn't have that gift. But he made me, first of all, he allowed me to imagine that something like that could be done, you know, that was a worthwhile thing to do. Brian talked about the works that I've done. If there's a common thread, it's that they are about community. Well, I mean, that's very broad in general, but I'm very interested in what makes a community tick, and that could be a religious community, it could be a town that's eaten up with basketball, it could be just what are the things that make people get excited or find a reason to believe? I'm a longtime Bruce Springsteen fan, and he has a song called Reason to Believe. And if that's one of the themes that runs through all the work I've done, again, from basketball players to monks to a social activist like John Howard Griffin, what was it that drove them to do what they did? What I'd like to do tonight is get your all's help in editing. I'm in the last month or so of my project on the Hubbards, and I'm going to show you about a 20-minute segment out of it. I know there's a few segments I'm not sure really work, and so you all are very hospitable and polite, but I'll ask you after we discuss it to say, you know, did this particular segment seem to fit? Did it work for you? And I hope you'll be honest in responding, because I'm still, James, our friend from PBS, knows that these programs have to be a certain time frame, and so I'm still needing to get down to 56 minutes. And so there's, as much as I like to think there's not a bit of flab in this, I know that there is. I'll give you just a little backstory. Again, Brian in his introduction talked about my admiration in the 60s and 70s for filmmakers like Scorsese and Truffaut, Coppola. Well, after I graduated from UK, I went to Los Angeles thinking, that's what I'll be. And, you know, that presumptuousness of somebody that's really not prepared to do it. After about a year in Los Angeles, I realized, you know, even if I could make it in a town like this, I don't know that I want to be here. Now, maybe that's a rationalization, but I felt that for my temperament, for my gifts, I wanted to be in a place like Kentucky, a place like home. And I think Kentucky has such a great history, tragic and happy, and there are so many rich characters. I guess a state that struggles, that has issues with poverty and race, that allows for a lot of juices to get going. And so I think there's a lot here that can keep you busy as long as you can pick up a camera. It's nice that cameras are getting lighter, because as I get older, I can pick up cameras easier and longer. But my time in Los Angeles, though, you know, nothing came from it as far as financial gain or a career start. I think it was good in that I wouldn't want to be at this stage of my life and say, gee, you know, if I'd only gone to Los Angeles, I could have been a contender. You know, I was there and I saw, you know, I'm convinced that if you're just determined to make it in the film business, you can make it, because Los Angeles is an industry town. And you may not make it as a director. You may go out there thinking you're going to be a director, and you wind up being an editor or a caterer or a lighting person. But there's enough jobs out there. If you stay long enough, you can work in L.A. But for me, it's been very satisfying to work in Kentucky. And almost all the stories either are rooted in Kentucky or people from Kentucky. The one I'm working on now, just about to complete, if anyone's in Louisville, November 12th, after this little taste, you can see the whole film or the whole program. Anna and Harlan Hubbard really appealed to me because in so many ways, like a skeptic might say, well, what's so special about them? All they did was sort of live off the grid for most of their lives. And that's, I think, putting the values and standards of a culture that they didn't buy into. What they wanted to do, well, one of the things that Harlan said is that a person should strive to make their life a masterpiece. And now that doesn't mean to become the richest person in the room or the most accomplished in some way, but to live your life so fully as a painter. I think that he wanted to just make it as full and rich as possible. So as I learned about the Hubbards and the way they went about that, I just found them fascinating. They lived a life that could be considered extreme, but I think all of us can find something in their lives that we can adapt to our own. Like, I know I'm not handy enough to build my own house or to, or patient enough to grow a garden and can the goods and things like that. But there are still ways of which they related to the environment, the way they related to each other, that I think are really would be worthwhile taking to heart. And so that's what I hope all people can find in their lives. Though it may be hard to imagine doing what they did, I think we can all find that way of living life more fully. What you'll see, this part you'll see, it's about a 20-minute segment. It comes about 30 minutes into the program. And what has happened is we've met Harlan and how he grew up in a little town just across from Cincinnati. He had one brother that went to Los Angeles and became a big-time producer. He had another brother that went to New York and became an acclaimed illustrator. All Harlan wanted to do, he read Thoreau, and he said, I want to live like Thoreau. So for the first 40 years of his life, that's essentially what he did. He worked construction to make a living, but he painted, he took care of his mother. If you would have looked at him, you would have said, well, this guy's going to be sort of the old bachelor. His wife, Anna, sort of came through a very different path. She grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, family that loved music, loved education. She got a graduate degree from Ohio State and then an advanced degree in library studies from a school in Cincinnati and was working in the fine arts department at the Cincinnati Library. Harlan, as a painter, would come over there and check out books, and they checked each other out and began to date and fell in love. And they were both in their 40s at this time. First thing they decided to do, Anna had been sort of an outdoors type, but she had never really been out on the Ohio River prior to meeting Harlan. Well, he told her about his dream of drifting down the Ohio River, and she said, let's do it. So they built what's called a shanty boat, and took them a while to do that. You'll see the process. And then they took 5 years floating from Cincinnati down to New Orleans and then through the bayous. And why it took 5 years, I mean, despite the fact they didn't have a motor, they would drift only in the winter when the current was up and the water was fast. And then in the spring, they'd find a place to stop. And I guess this was in the mid to late 40s. Farmers would allow this in those days. They'd find a piece of land and say, can we camp on your land for the next 6 months? And they found farmers that would say, sure. And they would grow a crop, harvest it, can it, dry it, and then come the winter, go off again. So this segment you're about to see will show that process. And it's narrated by Wendell Berry, who is one of Kentucky's treasures, one of our country's treasures, I think. One of the great thrills of any project is to meet the people who knew the person you're doing the program on. But in the case of Wendell Berry, it's just been a real honor to meet him, and I just think he's someone all Kentuckians can be proud of. The voice of Harlan Hubbard is portrayed by Will Oldham. Does anybody know Will Oldham, that name? He's a Louisvillian. He's a musician, an actor, interesting guy in his own right, and he goes by the pseudonym or nom de plume of Bonnie Prince Billy. And but Bonnie Prince Billy decided to help me out with this, and I think he does a nice job as Harlan. And a woman named Katie Blackerby, an actress, teacher, portrays Anna. And you'll hear a few other voices in here. So let's watch the movie, and then I'd like to discuss it afterwards.
At the time of his wedding, he was 43 years old. And he had believed for a long time that such a thing was not for him. And the woman he married was not only brilliant and beautiful, but she loved him devotedly.
Gone to look for other prospects, and I rode back to our substandard home to tell Anna all about it.
So that's the end of the journey, the shanty boat journey. Thank you. I forgot to tell you beforehand, and it was unfair, you would have known this. All those drawings and paintings were done by Harlan, with a few exceptions. After this, they come back to Kentucky, like all good Kentuckians do, and settled in Payne Hollow, the place they first wintered, and bought 7 acres of land initially, and that grew a little bit, and lived there for the next, well, Anna died in 1984 at 82 years old. She died in 86 at 84 years old, and Harlan died in 88 at 88 years old. And they lived like that almost until the very end. A remarkable couple. One of their biographers described both of them as wild souls. And I think we all have that wild soul, but we don't let it come out to the degree they did. But I just have endless regard and respect for their spirit. And somebody asked me, well, what'd they accomplish? I'll let you all judge that. But I think they lived rich, full lives, and you read their journals, and I've read journals of, go to the absurd extreme, Donald Trump, and I've read their journals, and if I'm choosing, I know which one I want to pick and which one seems to have led a fuller, richer life. Any questions before I ask you all some editing issues?
How did you really get started on doing this? I think it's fascinating.
Well,
I always felt like I was on the river floating with them.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I started it. Fortunately, the University of Louisville has all their papers. And Anna was, she always pushed Harlan to the front. You know, it's all about Harlan. And I mean, not that she didn't have a healthy self-image and ego, but she wasn't interested. She wanted to promote Harlan and his work and his painting and his books. So she didn't write much at all, but Harlan wrote a lot. I mean, he was a real journal keeper. And they are really, I did a documentary on Thomas Merton and read his journals. And Hubbard's are as deep and profound in their way. I mean, they're not just, gee, rainy day, went to the hardware store. You know, they're really thoughts about what's worthwhile in life, you know, why he's doing what he's doing, what he hopes other people might think of what they're doing. So anyway, U of L has this library archive, and so I got a lot of material there. A lot of the pictures of Anna came from her niece and nephew who still live in Grand Rapids. I went to Grand Rapids and worked with them. The Beringer Crawford Museum in Covington has a lot of their work, and I went there. And so it's like, if you've written a paper or a book yourselves or any project, you know, you start with this and that fits together and that leads you here. And that's the fun of it. Practicality-wise, you know, if you're paying yourself by the hour, it's sort of like the way Harlan was talking to the census taker. You know, you don't want to think about what it breaks down to, you know, per hour. I was able to raise enough funding to justify this. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes dollars and cents are one measure of justifying being able to do something. And I was able to do that with this. One of the reasons I developed my work the way I did was that I have a commercial corporate work that brings in some income that allows me to do things like this that I know aren't going to generate much money or whatnot. So it's a good balance. And I think, for me, it's healthy to have a foot in both worlds, because you can get ivory tower or you can get burnout in the commercial world. And I've enjoyed trying to do both. Maybe you spread yourself too thin, but it's what I've enjoyed.
Yeah, how do you decide how much film to devote each part of the life? Is the shanty boat the defining moment of their life, and you give it more time? Or?
Well, doing the river is hard, but just in trying to film the river, I appreciated a little bit of what they went through. I mean, one day we were going to go out. One of those scenes where you saw a real choppy river, that was, we had built sort of like a faux shanty boat that we were going to go out in, and it was, and I said, I'm not going out in that river. I mean, and there was people, you know, there at the dock said, I wouldn't go out there in that. But, you know, you've hired a crew, you've done all this trouble, and you're just sitting there. And the river just says, tough luck, you know, you wait till tomorrow or whenever. So you find the stories that you think will translate best and might show their character in ways. You know, like I love that, I love the census taker story. I love the story, and it was almost impossible to illustrate, of them being frozen in on the river. I mean, and they're playing violin and cello while they're being frozen in, and I'm thinking, you know, he said, well, what else could we do? You know, you couldn't get off the boat, but I'd be in dead panic mode, and, you know, they're... But, so you find things that you think, wow, that really says something to their character. And just... the laundry scene was a lot of fun to shoot. We had scouted out that camp. It's near Beargrass Creek in Louisville, which is... When we came home from that, after being near that water, unfortunately, it's so polluted, we really had to wash up. But it was a camp for either kids or homeless people, because we go and, you know, we had scouted this location, and then we go there, and there was all these structures built there that felt sort of bad, but we had to move them so we could still film there. And just, you know, authenticity-wise, it's probably in the ballpark. Is it dead on perfect? No. And I defer to Ken Burns to do the ones that are dead on perfect. But, I hope it, you know, it captures some of that. And it cracked me up that Harlan liked to wash things. You know, that's the way he, things that I would think of as chores, he would attack with just this, bring it on, let's do it. And that's something that you learn from these people you do stories about. You know, instead of, oh, I'm going to do this today, you know, he just came up swinging every day, which is remarkable. Yes?
Did he ever sell any of his block prints or any of his paintings?
Some, and it was torture for him, because they would say, how much is this one? And he'd go, I didn't paint it to have a price on it. And I'm not a good art critic, so I don't know how these things stack up with great art, but I think if you have a good agent, that can jack your value up, and that's something that he couldn't get his head around promoting himself. And but that didn't make him unhappy and not so that he didn't paint. He just painted because he had to paint, and he had like these license plates. They weren't license plates, but they were shaped like that, and they were made out of tin. And hundreds of these, with just these little scenes. He'd be out walking. He ran before running was cool, and the police used to stop him. This is when he lived in northern Kentucky. They'd say, what are you running from? And he said, I'm just running. You know, I just like to run. He may have been mad. Who knows? But it's like when the police stopped him with the bee thing. You know, they thought, who is this guy, and why is he doing what he's doing? I mean, he was just a different kind of person. Speaking of the bee, that's one for me that is sort of on the chopping block, as I've tried to condense that into a manageable story, but there's so many parts to it that, for me, it feels a little long and tedious at times. And reactions?
When you first started talking about him and the boat and what they had done on the boat, one of my recollections of all of the stories that I know was about the bees. And so that, when that was there, that was just one of those things that I think is important. I mean, it was stood out before I even knew what you were doing. And I agree that perhaps it could be condensed, but it is a good story in and of itself. You know, perhaps the parts with the with him going to town and the police and everything, maybe that part is, although that's really a juicy part of the story, it doesn't necessarily add to what is else's, you know, as the focal point of the fact that they had bees.
Yeah.
Because that in and of itself is unusual, even in that time and space, and
right.
Especially on the boat.
Yeah, I mean, who thinks... I think I'll go get some bees and put them on the boat we're traveling on. I mean, only Harlan would. And only Anna would go, good idea, dear.
What was the point for the bees on the boat? They were gathering the honey or eating the honey?
Gathering the honey. And, they wouldn't... Remember, they did not travel in the summer when the bees are active. So when they would dock for the summer, they'd take their hive off and just sort
set
of...
Set it on the beach.
Yeah.
The beach.
And towards the end of their journey, when they got to where it was too warm in the winter, they had to leave the bees on a shore someplace because they did not want to be around the bees when the bees were in full activity mode.
We tried that on the riverboat, and each day there were just fewer and fewer and fewer bees.
Yeah. Well, theirs thrived for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
I think the bee story is good because it shows determination, it shows this different way of looking at life that's really different from the rest of us. I didn't find it too long. Voice in some places almost disappeared.
Yeah, the soundtrack, there's a few, I was taking notes.
But I like the bee story because it shows just how different their whole train of thought it was from the rest of us people.
Right.
And I think that's important.
That they recycled and reused before that was popular. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about the Hubbards is that people will, you know, just almost worship Thoreau, who only did that for a year. And the Hubbards did it for a lifetime, or their lifetime together, and truly lived those values and those morals and didn't have any conveniences at Paint Hollow, with the exception of a gasoline motor on his boat in his declining years, like his last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And then he still wanted to row.
You know you're a Hubbard Lord.
I know. I'm very familiar. We've been to Paint Hollow.
Oh, really?
We know Paul.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We've got 3 of his works. Not Paul's, but Harlan's works.
Paul has good work, too.
Paul has excellent work. Yeah.
How about the guys in the back row? What could you relate to them at all?
Oh, absolutely. The free spirit that they had was absolutely.
I mean, they were hippies without being hippies. You know, I mean, they just sort of said.
There's the character of the hardworking, absolutely.
But they didn't have a. They weren't anti. Like, they weren't protesting anything really. They just sort of said, "This is the way we want to live." Late in their lives, as you all know. They built a nuclear plant almost directly across the river from them. And, you know, Wendell Berry and others were protesting it, and they said, "Won't you join us?" And they said, "Well, you know, just because we don't want electricity doesn't mean other people shouldn't have electricity." And so they just went on with their lives, and the nuclear plant sort of just imploded because it was built poorly and the economics weren't right. And so, you know, it was just in their steady way of, you know, well, we empathize with your protest, but, you know, don't include us in it because we have other. Wendell Berry states that their life without, you know, putting a capital P on it was a protest in a way of values that are sort of to be questioned, and so remarkable people.
Is there any way that recordings of their musical so-called expertise was put together? As we talked at dinner, she was a concert pianist, and he was a scratchy old violinist. Are there any records?
I have a tape,
audio
or
records, I'm talking
a
about.
Cassette or two of them playing, and it's
really
husbands and wives will chuckle at this. They're playing and he's playing in his way and not particularly well, and she's playing, and you're listening to it and you hear this sniffing, and you're not sure what the sound is at first, and then afterward you hear them discussing what it's played back to them, and someone is still recording, and Harlan goes, "What's that sniffing sound?" And she goes, "That's you, dear." And he said, "Do I sniff when I play all the time?" She said, "Yes, dear, you've been doing it for 30-something years," and I'm sure she's thinking,
"I wish you would."
You know, it was just his habit of, you know, it just unconsciously. And
that would be a fun thing to incorporate someplace.
Well, I think I might do it in the credits, because, I mean,
it is a definite showstopper because, well, it's not real good. It's 30 years old on a set. But it's, I mean, the plane is so bad.
He was bad.
Yeah, I mean, he... But
the drifting is a showstopper. I mean, so it's well.
Yeah.
How do you balance showing the drawings with the actors portraying and come to a balance between the two?
Budget. I mean, there's only so many reenactments that I can afford or want to afford. I'm all for reenactments, and I have some friends that do documentaries that sort of don't feel the same way and are a little purer, I guess, in their approach. But, I mean, I feel that you can strike a balance. And there are certain things. Later in the show, I recreated the piano being brought to Panama, which I just said, that's such a metaphor for their life, bringing this piece of culture into the woods, essentially. And so I hired this piano company, these four very large guys, and they had a hollowed out piano. So, you know, I didn't ask them to bring the full baby grand in. And we had a big time one August day, traipsing up and down the hills is there. And, you know, they're sort of faking it because they only weighed 150 pounds, but, you know, when it's 95 degrees out and you're walking through the woods, you're still working up a pretty good sweat.
Without a driveway.
Yeah, you're right.
And steep, yeah.
Yeah. So I try to think of what's possible. I talk about my experience in L.A., what I found for myself and my temperament. I've had a few commercial shows where I've had relatively big crews, and I don't enjoy it. It's too much for me to deal with. You know, I don't like having 10 or 12, 15 people to try to manage, direct. So three or four people crews about as big as I want to try to handle. And again, I guess maybe it's grand case of rationale, but I think there's room for both. There's room for the big spectacle feature film, and there's room for smaller pieces that still tell a story.
When do you think it'll be completed?
Well, we're close now. So many of these effects go through a process called After Effects, which is like watching paint dry. It's very tedious, but it's all been shot, it's all there, he's just processing it, and so to do a couple of minutes takes a day sometimes, and so we're slowly putting it together. And it'll be, I'm having a showing in Louisville November 12th, and then in Hanover, at the Clifton Center, and do one in Hanover in late November, and part of my goals for this, I'm almost certain KT will show it, and you always aspire to a national showing. I don't know. It depends. They're probably too far under the radar to get a national PBS showing. With the Merton program, I reached what for me is the gold ring, where you have a one night, I mean, every PBS station in the country essentially is showing it at the same time, the same night, and you go, yay, that's great. The other path for this probably will be something that they call NETA, N-E-T-A, and the PBS director in Kentucky puts it up on the satellite. Program directors around the country bring it down and show it 2 a.m., 3 p.m., you know, they just drop it into spots where they need it or want to put it. And then I'll do showings. I think because of the very green aspect of this and how much that's appreciated these days, it'll have a life where I can do showings to Sierra clubs and
film festivals. Around
yeah, America. Things like that.
Documentary channel?
Yeah. But, you know, as they say, Mama, don't let your son and daughters grow up to be cowboys. You know, there's not a whole lot of money in most of those channels.
Right.
I mean, they think they're doing you a favor, in a sense they are, but you know, it's they don't have a lot of money. It's not like they're hoarding it. I mean, it's just it's a tough market.
Actually, I had a couple of questions for you. Did you interview a whole lot of people that
never? I decided not to, but and there were ample amount of people like Paul and Wendell Berry and With this, I just wanted their voices to tell it, supplemented by Wendell. I mean, I've done a lot of talking head driven pieces, and I enjoy those well enough, but for this one, I thought I just wanted them to tell the story.
No, that suits the mood of their lives.
Well, I hope, you know, I hope they don't get tiresome, but I mean, that can be a problem, but.
I think you've done a lovely job in this piece, anyway, of weaving together their words from the journals. Probably some of her words from her biography,
yeah,
as well as woodblocks and the drawings and the watercolors and even the oils that are in there. I think yeah. That's really, and then when you threw in the map, that little piece of the Ohio River map, you know, it's just oh gosh, I really felt like that was woven together quite well.
Good.
I love the spoon on the little.
Yeah, I mean that's the way he did those woodcuts. The guy who demonstrated that, a guy named Bill Cadell, and he is the, I guess, artistic heir of the Harlan left the bulk of his paintings to him and the house to Paul and let them fight. Unfortunately, as with sometimes when noted people die, the people left behind don't always behave.
Some sour grapes.
Yeah, right.
What did they do with the boat when they?
The boat they sold to some guy down in the bayous who was going to use it to ferry his cattle across the bayous, I think.
They did take a lot of the pieces from it, and they actually incorporated them into their home as well.
Yeah.
Their bed and a part of the hearth was all part from the boat.
Throughout the film, do you ever get to see the piano?
The actual, there are a few pictures, yeah, coming up.
One of the next segments?
Yeah. Yeah. And
how will we know of your release date?
I'll let Brian know and make sure.
Brian,
go on your website.
Yeah.
Your Facebook page.
Yeah, right.
Any other questions?
Yes.
So will your next documentary be on Wendell Berry?
I wish, and I've certainly dropped enough hints, but he has said that he wants no part of that.
Really?
Though a woman named Laura Dunn is doing something on him now. If you go to the IMDb page, she's doing something. The way it's described on that is that looks at America's environmental problems through the eyes of farmer Wendell Berry.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's his story or if it's just his sort of essay vision.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, KT is just keep saying, get Wendell to do it. And well, I mean, it's not like we're tight friends or anything. And he has other filmmaker friends. Have you all heard of Apple Shop?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's very good friends with some of the people there. I think if he does anything, he'll do it with them first.
Wow.
Yes.
And to me, I think it's kind of like bring my experience of America story to a full circle. Like I started learning about America with a professor back in China about Emerson, Transcendentalism, Thoreau. And now I see, now I see transcendentalism is
in
practice.
It. Yeah, right.
So that's very interesting. So I think the V can be like in a drama, a prop, kind of showing that how they want to be close to nature.
Yeah.
Even brought the nature to the boat.
Yes.
See that in the breeze.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find a way. It's about 3.5-4 minutes, and it needs to be about 2 minutes. And there's. The way he wrote the story is just constructed in such a way you think, well, if you take that part out, the whole thing collapses.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for our door prize. We always have one of these, and just to take a little
gift.
Oh, I'll do that. Okay, there you get now. Well, Nancy Bear. Yeah. Brand new WKU lottery teacher. Thanks for
having me. Oh, thank you.
We'll maybe do one more.
Our new emblem.
Eileen.
job.
Good job.
Good job.
Good job.
Good job.
And Morgan, thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. It's been
wonderful
to have, thrilled to have you here. Sorry we didn't have a bigger crowd. I mentioned it. Morgan, we were competing against kind of Pulitzer Prize winning photography show over in the journalism building. But it's a thrill, and we look forward to seeing you again. And a little token of our appreciation.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Is this some Western gear that you're calling me with?
From our very own museum store. Thanks, everybody, and have a good evening. We'll be back at Barnes & Noble the second week of October, and we'll be hearing a program on a German immigrant's impression of the Civil War as he passed through Bowling Green and left a lot of illustrations as well. So,